go. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Bible Quest. This is the Wednesday edition. I hope that all of you who are watching us live on YouTube, sorry about last week, the technical glitches we had, but we're live on YouTube today. Hope you'll join in on the conversation. You can text us using the chat window, or you can email us directly by using BibleQuest.org@gmail.com.
And we got all kinds of things happening over here that I've got to stop all kinds of things here. Hold on.
Oh, boy. You know, every week that Jeff, just take it away.
Good afternoon, folks. I'm Jeff Smeltzer, next in Pennsylvania. And with me today are Chase Byers and Joe Works. Chase Byers in Fishers, Indiana. We're going to give Chase primary billing here because we are honored that he has decided to spend an afternoon with us. He rarely deigns to do so. What do you think, Joe?
Well, you know, after the strike, that you know, he's finally decided to come back to work. So I think we need to give him some airtime here.
Well, I'll go back on strike when I start getting compensated better.
So today we are going to talk about Jesus and especially the resurrection. And Chase is going to kind of help us understand some viewpoints that deny that some would deny Jesus was a real person. Some would deny that he was crucified. Some would deny that he was buried in the tomb. And of course, some would deny that he was raised from the dead. And there's some who would deny all of that. And so we're going to talk about those points. So Chase, I guess the first question we're going to start with here is, was Jesus of Nazareth a real person? There are a lot of people, I don't know a lot of people, but there are people who think that he was just a fictional character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So I'm fairly certain Richard Carrier would be in that category.
Who is Richard Carrier?
Another leading voice amongst atheists and agnostics. He's written a few books, done some lectures on the issue of Jesus even was a real person. And there are a lot of people who won't even take that to be a true fact, but the majority of historians will accept the fact that Jesus of Nazareth was a real person. And further than that, he was a real person who was doing some teaching, had a following, was a rabbi, was a Jewish rabbi that people were leaving their lives behind to come and follow. And there are some quotes outside of the Bible. That's kind of outside of the preview for our lesson today. But there are quotes outside of the Bible that would attest to that from both Roman history, Jewish history, and Greek history as well. And so Jesus, I would start with, I would agree, was a real person, even if I was a historian who denied his deity.
Well, it's probably worth taking just a moment to cite a couple of those secular references to Jesus. One of my favorites is Tacitus. Tacitus was a Roman historian. When did Tacitus write? Early in the second century, right after the end of the first century. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And I've lost you guys. I know you're there, but I've lost. I don't see you on my screen here for some reason.
Yeah, we're still here.
There you are. So Tacitus was describing Nero's reign, and he was talking about the burning of Rome and how people were blaming Nero. There was a theory that Nero was interested in some urban renewal, some rebuilding, and that maybe he wanted to further that by burning down a lot of the older buildings. And so to redirect blame, Tacitus talks about how Nero blamed the followers of Crestus. And I think it's in that passage where he goes on to say who was crucified or who was put to death by Pontius Pilate.
I've got the quote right here. Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate.
Yeah, and it's interesting that just in what you read there, it's clear that Tacitus himself doesn't have a whole lot of sympathy for these Christians. It's not that he is an apologist for them. He describes them as guilty of, how did it say, the most abominable crimes or something like that. And yet he recognized that they were being made scapegoats by Nero. And the point being that he acknowledged that they were followers of this man, Christ, who was crucified by Pontius Pilate. And so that's interesting. There's also, do you have Suetonius's quote
there? Yeah, I've got Suetonius, Roman historian, the chief secretary of the Roman Emperor Hadrian. So this would have been in, again, the second century. But he says, because the Jews at Rome caused continuous disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he expelled them from the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then in another quote, and that would be a reference to Acts 18. And then in another quote, he says, after the great fire of Rome, punishments were also inflicted on the Christians, a sect professing a new and mischievous religious belief. So, yeah.
So I don't think I have to have those quotes to know that Jesus existed. I believe there's great credibility in the records we have in the Bible. But if somebody is starting from a point of skepticism and they suppose the Bible may be just a fabrication of some sort, I think it is interesting that, well, the fact is sources that were not sympathetic to Jesus acknowledged his existence. And we're not talking about sources that are writing years after or centuries after Jesus. We're talking about people who lived within 60, 70 years of Jesus, yeah. 80 years in some case. So I think all of that is significant.
And like you said, not speaking favorably of Jesus or the Christians, just right. Recording it as history. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that really plays into it. Are there any other quotes you would want to mention?
You know, I don't know how. Well, that'll do for that. Let's talk about the second question here. All right, if Jesus was a real person, was he in fact crucified on a Roman cross? Did he get put to death in about the year AD 30, 33, something like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, same thing. I mean, even outside of the Bible, there are going to be different ways you can make that case. Lucian of Samosata, or how do you say that? Samosata? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's recorded, and again, this isn't within the first century. He says, the Christians, you know, worship a man to this day who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. These misguided creatures deny the gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage and live after his laws.
Obviously not sympathetic, but stating the fact.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, there is this too. There are some who don't doubt that he was put on the cross, but some, I don't know that anybody currently argues this, but in the past there have been some who've argued, trying to explain the resurrection, that he did not actually die on the cross, that he was taken down from the cross and he was unconscious, and that he was resuscitated while lying in the cool air of the tomb, and that he then escaped.
Yeah, so we call that swoon theory, and what it would then have to be is that Jesus was lying, because he comes out of the tomb and he starts saying, I've been resurrected, I have risen, I'm raised now. But it really is, it's a preposterous thing to suggest when you take into consideration what Roman crucifixion was and what Jesus endured before he even got to the cross. When you think about the scourging, and when you think about the crown of thorns being beaten into his skull repeatedly, the blood loss and the concussions that would have come from that, it really is kind of a silly theory. And then finally, the spear being stabbed in his side and the blood and the water coming out, it really is it's a wild thing to even suggest, in my opinion, that he did not die.
If you could imagine that he was only unconscious in that grave, here's somebody who has been physically abused for, at this point, by the time he's put in the tomb, he's been up all night, been abused, then scourged by the Romans, and then crucified, and had a sword stuck in his side, had nails driven through his hands and his feet, and loss of all the blood and all of that. And then he's put in this tomb. Now, let's understand this tomb. It was hewn out of solid rock. So it's like a cave with a stone rolled over the door. And that stone was a large stone. There were several women who went to the tomb on the first day of the week to prepare to anoint the body. And on the way there, they are saying to themselves, this is from Mark 15, verse 3, who shall roll us away the stone from the door of the tomb? And Mark goes on to say, looking up, they see that the stone is rolled back, and he explains, for it's exceeding great. So Mark is making the point that the reason they were wondering who was going to remove the stone, and then they get there and the stone is removed, that they were astonished is because this was a very large stone. Three women, or however many women there were, did not believe they could move it together. So we're going to now believe that a stone that large, somebody who has been abused all night, who has been crucified, who's had a spear driven into his side, is now going to have the strength to get up and move the stone. That doesn't sound very likely.
Yeah, no, I agree. And what people are reporting when they're seeing Jesus is not somebody who is bloodied and maimed, like coming out. Now, granted, it sounds like his resurrected body still had the imprints of the nails and from the spear going into his side, but the recovery that he would have had from the scourging a lot of doctors, when they've kind of examined what would happen on crucifixion, they talk about both of your shoulders would have fallen out of place at that point, your chest being sunk in, you die of asphyxiation, your lungs would need to be fully repaired at that point. I mean, it's really ridiculous to suggest in 3 days somebody could walk out. I don't have the quote on me, but Josephus also records three people who are crucified, two of which die of their injuries. One, they were able to revive back, but it took months and months and months to revive that one person that came off of a Roman cross. So, I mean, it really is it's just an impossibility.
You have that reference. I was not aware of that, where Josephus talks about that.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to carry the conversation? I can pull it up.
That's all right. Don't worry about it. So, but anyway, the real point here is that there's really the only reason for assuming Jesus didn't die is you're trying to explain the resurrection. Thomas is so convinced that Jesus was dead that even when the others say, no, we've seen him raised from the dead, he said, I will not believe unless I can see the prints of the nails and put my finger into the prints and so on. Go ahead.
I'll say one other thing. I mean, if Jesus had really not died and he came out looking like this, are we really ready to believe that that's a man who could convince these men to follow him to their death at that point? I mean, that would be a pitiful looking man who has not defeated death, even though he would be claiming that he did. I just don't buy that he could convince them of that. Joe,
would it be a part of this conversation that if he wasn't actually raised from the dead, if this swoon theory if we were to take that serious, that's going to make Jesus a liar. He's going to say he's going to die and he's going to be raised 3 days from the dead. So that's going to make him a liar. It's going to deny the power of the resurrection. Think about that. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how do these people that write these conclusions, I think the swoon theory was kind of invented about the 1700s, I think, is that right? To come up with those kinds of theories, it's like they accept a portion of the Bible, but then they're like, oh, but none of these other things are true. We throw everything else out. It just seems so disingenuous. How can we take the accounts, but only up to the non-miraculous, I guess?
Well, Paul's famous statement in 1 Corinthians 15, where he says, He says that we are found false witnesses of God if Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, because we witnessed of God that he raised up Christ, whom he raised not up, if so be that the dead are not raised. For if the dead are not raised, neither has Christ been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, your faith is vain. You're yet in your sins. And though they also that are fallen asleep in Christ have perished, if we've only hoped in Christ in this life, we're of all men most pitiable. In other words, Christianity becomes pointless if Jesus wasn't raised from the dead. So the idea that we're going to talk about Jesus as a great teacher and a role model for us today, if he wasn't raised from the dead, what did you say? He was a liar? He was a fraud?
Yeah.
The fact is we are on the horns of a dilemma between two extremes here. If Jesus was not raised from the dead and he claimed he would be, if he was not what he claimed he was not the Son of God, did not have power over death, then what was he? He's a guy who goes around making outlandish claims. He has delusions of grandeur. He's a nut at best and an outright liar and fraud at worst.
I apologize. Drew asked a good question. If he didn't die, well, then where was he after that? I mean, because the Bible records an ascension, right, guys? Like 40 days later, he ascended into heaven. Well, it's interesting, Joe, the reason I paused when you said, well, it was in the 17th century that people were saying he didn't die. What's actually interesting is the Quran actually has a quote where a certain sect of Muslims take it to mean that Jesus never actually died on a cross. And that sect of Muslims go on to teach and say that Jesus lived out his days in India.
I baptized a guy who was a Muslim some years ago, and he was telling me, he was explaining what he was taught. He was taught that before the crucifixion, as he understood it, Jesus was in a house when they went to get him. And when they went in to get him, Jesus changed his appearance and Judas's appearance so that there was a misidentification, and they grabbed Judas and they thought they had grabbed Jesus, and that Judas was the one who got crucified. And so Jesus then was never crucified.
So what Muslims are trying to make sense of, I'll just read it. So this is in the Quran. This is Surah 4, 155 to 158. This is what the Quran says. They were condemned for breaking their covenant, rejecting Allah's signs, killing the prophets unjustly, and for saying our hearts are unreceptive. It is Allah who has sealed their hearts for their disbelief, so they do not believe except for a few. And for their denial and outrageous accusation against Mary, and for boasting, we killed the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, the messenger of Allah. But they neither killed nor crucified him. It was only made to appear so. Even those who argue for this crucifixion are in doubt. They have no knowledge whatsoever, only making assumptions. They certainly did not kill him. Rather, Allah raised him up to himself, and Allah is almighty, all wise. So different Muslims are torn on what that means. For some, they purport Judas and Jesus switched bodies. But for some, they just say, well, that means Jesus never died on the cross, like the Ahmadiyya Muslims. So
he was caught up to heaven. He was caught up to heaven before that event, right?
Right, yes. Well, guys, so here's the reason why I kind of had Jeff do this for us, right? Where Jeff started with, well, was Jesus crucified? And was he a real person? And did, you know, what happened to his body? Because those are some historical facts that people don't deny. He was real. He was crucified. And then 3 days later, his tomb was empty and people were saying he rose from the dead. Well, if I don't want to admit that he rose from the dead, I have to come up with something. I have to say something happened to explain what would appear to be some miraculous things. And so we covered swoon theory, but I'm just going to rapid fire a couple others out there. And you guys tell me which ones you think would be worthy of our time. There's theft theory. Maybe we can start with that one because that's what they were saying in the first century. Then there's fabrication theory. There's people who say that the story of the resurrection didn't come about until much, much later, hundreds of years later, actually. There's the wrong tomb theory, where some suggest the women actually just went to the wrong tomb. There's the hallucination theory that all of these people just are hallucinating seeing Jesus. And then there's one about memory distortion.
With the wrong tomb theory, because the wrong tomb theory, you know, the third thing we were going to talk about is that the fact that Jesus was buried in a tomb and it was found empty 3 days later. The wrong tomb theory says it wasn't found empty. They went to the wrong tomb. The empty tomb was a different tomb. So that theory would be Jesus was crucified. He was put in a tomb and his body was there evermore, decaying in that tomb. And that people went to another tomb and found it empty. And so I think that's one that's fun to talk about.
Yeah, so this one actually came about by a guy named Kirsop Lake in 1907. He wrote a book called The Historical Evidence for the Resurrection of Jesus Christ. And he was kind of a late German rationalist, somebody who's trying to say that there's rational explanations for what you read in the Bible. There were real things that happened that were just extrapolated on and made legendary as the centuries went on. But he was kind of the first one to say this, and he liked going to Mark 16. So why don't we do that? And he liked reading and referencing what happens whenever Mary gets to the tomb, when Mary, the mother of James and Salome, and Mary Magdalene get there. In verse 5, when they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he told them. "You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified." Let me tell you, I'm going to skip the part that he skips, okay?
The part where the guy says he's risen?
He skips that part, and then he says, "He is not here. See the place where they put him?" So Blake skips that part, actually mashes this up with John's gospel, where Mary mistakes the guy for thinking she sees a gardener. And he says that what really probably happened is Mary saw the gardener, looked in a tomb, saw it was empty, and then the guy said, "Yeah, you're looking for Jesus. He's not here." And she ran away in astonishment, thinking Jesus had risen, when really the gardener was just trying to say, "He's not here. This isn't the right tomb."
So one of the things about this, and maybe this is just a simple take on it, but this is not like Arlington Cemetery, where you know there are thousands and thousands of stones and, you know, markings and so forth. This was Joseph of Arimathea's burial place, a prominent member of the Jewish leadership. You know, if the wrong tomb had been chosen, you would think that some people who weren't friends with Joseph and Nicodemus after this, you know, would have, you know, pointed out, "Wait a second, that's Joseph's tomb over there," you know, and this whole thing would have been over with in a couple of days.
Yeah. And Nicodemus was a ruler of the Jews, and he went with Joseph to Joseph's own tomb to put the body there. So they certainly could vouch for whether this is the right tomb or not. And then in Luke's account, it says this in verse 54 of Luke 23, after Jesus is crucified. "It was the day of the preparation," the preparation for the Sabbath day. "And the Sabbath drew on, and the women who had come with him out of Galilee followed after, beheld the tomb, how his body was laid, and they returned and prepared spices and ointments," which they intended to bring back and are going to come back on the first day of the week after the Sabbath. So it's not as if they had been told vaguely, "Well, you go down there and you go down this little lane and it's five or six tombs on the left," or something like that. They had gone and observed which tomb it was and exactly how the body was placed in the tomb.
So let me tell you what Lake would say to that. And I quote, this is what he said regarding the women. "So far as their frame of mind at the time of the burial was concerned, the women were certainly not fit to take notes. They had spent the day in watching the dying agony of their master and it is not in human nature at such a time to calmly consider a question of locality. So he's basically saying they would be too distraught to take note of exactly where the tomb is.
And when did this guy write?
1907 was when this book was published.
So he has a better record of where Jesus was laid, 1870 years after Jesus, than the women that were actually there.
And apparently has a better pulse on exactly how they were feeling in that moment, enough to make the decision that they couldn't have been able to remember where the tomb was. It's unsatisfactory. And I will say this, guys, this one is silly. Most scholars dismiss this theory. They recognize it doesn't hold water. The biggest thing is what Joe said. I mean, the Jews and the Romans would have been all too happy to point out their mistake if this was the case. Oh, he's actually over here, and go look. You know,
the Roman guards would have been like, "Hey guys, can we get somebody to switch places with us? Because we've been waiting here."
This has always been impressive to me, the idea that the tomb was not empty, that his body was still there. So now we have a situation where within weeks, the gospel is being publicly proclaimed on the basis of the claim of resurrection. On the day of Pentecost in Acts 2, Peter's whole sermon is about the fact that Christ was to be raised from the dead, and they are witnesses that Jesus was raised from the dead. As you go through the book of Acts, as the gospel spreads and the Christianity spreads through the world, both Jews and Gentiles, it is consistently predicated on the claim that Jesus was raised from the dead. Also, in the book of Acts, you see opposition from the get-go. The Sadducees in particular, who do not believe in resurrection, and who control the upper echelons of the priesthood, so they're your prominent religious leaders, and their constituency, their credibility with their constituency is undermined by this preaching that not only was Jesus raised from the dead, but that means that the listeners can have a hope of resurrection. Well, if you're being taught that you should be looking forward to resurrection, and your religious leaders down at the temple, the Sadducees, say there is no resurrection, that undermines their credibility and their authority. So they were motivated to put a stop to this. And so they arrest the apostles in Acts chapter 4 and again in Acts chapter 5. They are interested in putting a stop to this spread of this message, and they have the power to do it if it can be done. And yet they never went to the tomb and dragged out the body to say, here's your risen Savior, which they could have done if Jesus was still in the tomb. And yes, let's suppose Kersop Lake makes some kind of case that, well, maybe the women got confused in the wrong tomb. Well, Nicodemus knew which tomb it was, and he was one of the rulers of the Jews. Joseph Arimathea knew it was his tomb, and yet this message predicated on the claim that Jesus was raised spreads not only in Jerusalem and Judea, but then it spreads from there throughout the whole world. And today, 2,000 years later, Christianity is what it is. So I challenge anyone today to start a new religion based on the claim that somebody who died 3 weeks ago is actually has come back to life, and just see how far you get with that. And see if 100 years from now or 1,000 years from now, people all over the world are believing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are all really great points.
I wonder, and Chase, I may be just saying things out of order for you. I apologize if I am. But I'm thinking about all of this and then considering Peter's sermon in Acts 2. So, you know, here we are, we're 50 days after the crucifixion of Jesus, and so again, not 2 months have passed, and in Peter's sermon in verse 29, when he says, "Men and brethren, let me speak freely to you, the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us to this day," and then he goes on and talks about the resurrection. I wonder if that phrase, "his tomb is with us," would not have been a pretty strong, you know, I kind of just read over that, but I wonder if that would not have just been an amazing argument for them hey, David's tomb is, but he talked about a resurrection, and there's another tomb that isn't. You know, it's vacant. Would that be an appropriate way of seeing it?
Yeah, and other apologetics people have cited this as good evidence. This is a very good place to go. Yeah.
So your fourth question is, all right, in spite of all of this, we've got people who claim to see Jesus risen from the dead after those 3 days. Did they?
Yeah, so that ultimately goes to a question of, is eyewitness testimony credible? And this is where you'll get a variety of opinions, right? Because if you just start by saying eyewitness testimony shouldn't be credible, like we shouldn't be using it in any, not even in courts of law, like, and then cite a bunch of examples where eyewitness testimony was wrong. You throw out the eyewitness testimony, then obviously it's hard to really back up some of the historicity of Jesus's resurrection. But I would obviously argue that eyewitness testimony is reliable, especially when you have multiple eyewitnesses attesting to a fact. Does that make sense?
Yep. Yep. I mean, somebody could argue, well, there have been cases where people had multiple witnesses testified to something that wasn't true. But consider this. On that first time that, as far as we know, the gospel is publicly preached after Jesus has ascended back to heaven, on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2, Peter says, this Jesus has God risen from the dead, whereof we are all witnesses. That's what he does. He says, we're witnesses. And 3,000 people, 3,000 people listening to Peter make that claim, we believe that, and they were baptized. Now, if I stand in front of an audience of several thousand people and I say, Ronald Reagan has been raised from the dead, I don't think 3,000 of them are going to believe me. Why did 3,000 people believe Peter when he says, we're all witnesses? Well, there's several things. They're the phenomenal events of that day that they've just witnessed. In the beginning of Peter's remarks, he reminds them of the miracles they knew Jesus had done. And so when you have a crowd of people and 3,000 of them say, yes, I believe that guy when he says he saw so-and-so raised from the dead, you have to ask your question, I mean, why would those people believe that at that time? And then you factor in what they'd already seen, Jesus's miracles, the events of the day of Pentecost, and they were prepared to believe that. I think we have to put ourselves in their shoes. It's not just a question of did anybody claim Jesus was raised from the dead? It's did credible people claim that Jesus was raised from the dead, made credible by the signs that they were able to perform?
Yeah. No, I think that is the starting spot. And when you look at the kind of people Jesus is, you know, appearing to, it is more than just the apostles. It's not just the apostles, and it's not just the women that were following him. There's, of course, Cleopas and the other disciple that's mentioned on the road to Emmaus in Luke 24.
I like that story.
Yeah, and I have a lot of questions about it too. Nothing bad, but just it's so isolated in Luke's gospel, and it's really cool to think about. But as well as the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 9 and 1 Corinthians 15, he says he saw the risen Christ when he was talking about Jesus appearing to him on the road to Damascus in Acts 9. And here was somebody who was a persecutor of this religion. I mean, what would he have to gain to lie and say that he saw the risen Jesus when in fact it was just a vision or a dream or just something he decided to randomly do? There was nothing he could gain. He actually lost everything instead.
In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is writing to the Christians in Corinth, and he is writing about 20 years after the events. And so we're talking about considerable distance from Jerusalem. But when he writes to them about the resurrection, and by the way, you have there in the church among the Christians some people who are who don't believe in the idea of resurrection. I think people sometimes misread this and suppose Paul is saying they don't believe in Jesus' resurrection. It seems that they were accepting Jesus' resurrection, but they didn't believe in just their hope of resurrection. And so Paul reminds them of the premise that Jesus was raised. He says, this is what we preach to you, and you know this, but if there's no such thing as resurrection, then you're going to have to give up this, and here are the implications of that. But as he does so, and he reminds them of the fact of Jesus' resurrection, he does reinforce it. And he says this, after talking about Jesus appearing to various people, he says in verse 6, then he appeared to above 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain until now, but some are fallen asleep. What is the point of his mentioning that of the 500 brethren Jesus appeared to, most of them are still alive at the time that he writes this, 20 years after the crucifixion and resurrection? What's the point of mentioning that most of them are still alive?
I would imagine so that those who are trying to fact check Paul can be like, well, I guess we can go talk to these people.
That's his point. It is verifiable. There are still many eyewitnesses 20 years later. So the gospel was not proclaimed on the basis of a feeling or on the basis of a wish. It was proclaimed upon the basis of verifiable evidence. Jesus was raised from the dead. There are witnesses. You can check it out. You can talk to them. And somebody may question, well, yeah, sure, that's easy enough to claim in Corinth, how many hundreds of miles away from Jerusalem, who's going to check it out? But the fact is, one of the things that's remarkable as you pay attention to the geography of the New Testament and people getting around, people got around. It's amazing how well traveled they were. And so Paul is, he's not bluffing here. You can check it out. So I think that's compelling.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. All of 1 Corinthians 15, these first 8 verses are, I think they're the bedrock for some of the evidence for the resurrection. And I will say, this is something I thought was worth noting. In verse 1, when he says, I want to make clear to you, verse 3, for I passed on to you as most important what I also received. There are some who would suggest that what Paul goes on to cite in verses 3 to 7-ish would be an early Christian creed. Like this was the facts of the gospel, or the crucifixion of Jesus, rather, in condensed form. And this was something that would be cited. And Paul is saying, look, I received this and I delivered it to you. Some would cite that to show actually what Paul is writing down in verses 3 through 8 would be even older than what, 56 AD? Is that when 1 Corinthians was written? So it goes even further back than that, just to try and get that date closer to the events of it. But yeah, so I just thought I'd throw that out there. Guys, what do you think about the apostles, or not even just the apostles, somebody stealing the body of Jesus? I mean, that seems like an appropriate thing. Maybe the apostles did that. Jesus had predicted 3 times that he was going to be killed and crucified and raised. And then on that third day, when nothing was happening, they got antsy and they went in and they stole the body of Jesus. And if it wasn't
who?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of possibilities, Jeff. It could have been the apostles, it could have been grave robbers.
Let's take it one at a time. The apostles stole the body. And then they're going to then go about preaching the gospel and be thrown in jail. James is put to death in Acts, the 12th chapter.
And you forgot about who gets to be the Jesus imposter. Somebody had to walk around as Jesus for 40 days.
Oh, yeah. Thomas.
They had to pull the wool over his eyes.
So whoever it is that stole the body had to have stolen it over the opposition of the Roman soldiers.
Right.
You know, to me, that's, I this whole conversation, I've been fairly silent, which is maybe somewhat a surprise to people. But it just seems so preposterous. It's really grasping at straws at every point. I'm thinking about conspiracy theories that we hear today, and I'm thinking, we've got nothing on these people. You know, every idea that is presented is like, well, but maybe this happened. And, you know, wow, there's so much evidence for the resurrection. If we'll just take a look.
Yeah.
You know, what's funny, guys, I'll share this because I thought it was really funny. So Tertullian, am I saying his name right? He listen to what he wrote down in one of his writings there in the first or second, third century. This is he whom his disciples secretly stole away, that it might be said he had risen again, or the gardener abstracted him, that his lettuces might come to no harm from the crowds of visitants.
That his lettuces?
Yeah. So it's actually a joke. It's Tertullian making fun of people who were legitimately claiming in his day that the gardener had stolen the body of Jesus.
So they wouldn't trample through his garden.
I just think it's really funny. But it does show you, and sorry, I very flippantly said first or second century. I can't remember what century Tertullian
writes near the end of the second century.
Okay.
Late second, early third, right about 200.
But what that shows you is that even then, there are people who are saying somebody stole the body. But anyways, I just thought that was so funny. but you know what? All of these theories, they fall apart. There's holes in all of them. Celsus, in his was a third century heretic, in his debate with Origen, this is what Origen said to him. I'm paraphrasing, but frightened men do not risk their lives and suffer martyrdom to perpetuate a lie. And so if the Gospels if the Gospel records are reliable, these disciples are trembling behind locked doors, afraid to venture out, unwilling even to believe the stories of the women about an empty tomb. Can anyone genuinely believe these men had enough courage to steal away the body and carry off this deception? I think that's a great point Origen was making, even in the third century.
There's a line there that brings a thought to mind. You know, the last thing we see of the disciples as Jesus is being led away, they're fleeing. They're in a panic. Peter is denying that he even knows Jesus. For all he's worth, he's denying it because he does not want to suffer the same fate. He does not want to get caught up as the target by the people who are arresting Jesus. Now, you take those people, and those are the people who are going to go and steal the body? That doesn't sound right.
Yeah. So all of these ideas, I mean, this was kind of the conclusion I'd come to on some of it. It's amazing. We actually call these the naturalistic explanations. That's often what these are called. But all of these naturalistic explanations would actually take something miraculous for them to be true. And so the whole time people are fighting against the miraculous idea that the creator of the world rose his son from the dead 3 days after his crucifixion. They can't believe that, but then they will give these wildly statistically impossible things to have happened to explain the impossible.
So
at what point do I just need to yield and say God was the son from the dead?
If I feel compelled to come up with a naturalistic explanation for the empty tomb, what about walking on the water? Do I need a naturalistic explanation for that?
No. If you believe Jesus raised from the dead, no. But if you, yeah, otherwise, then yeah.
Do I need a naturalistic explanation for feeding 5,000?
Yep.
Do I need a natural explanation for raising Lazarus from the dead?
Yep.
Do I need a naturalistic explanation for the flood? Do I need a naturalistic? The point is, how much of the Bible is supernatural? If I'm going to take one thing and say, well, that couldn't have happened, there are a whole lot of things I'm going to have to say couldn't have happened. And by the time I take out all of those things and just explain them away with naturalistic explanations, contrary to what the Bible says, what am I left with?
Nothing. You have nothing at the end of that journey. So, well, guys, I think that's our time. Thank you all so much for listening today. If you have any questions or comments, anything you want to send in for us to talk about, feel free to do that at BibleQuest.tv. We appreciate you listening today. We hope everyone has a good week.
All right. Not bad.
I'm trying to set up dismount. I know